The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
The more casualties you have, the harder it is to say that everything is, you know, everything is fine and everything's going to plan. The longer this drags on, the harder it is to say that that's the case. And, you know, we've had so many signals, both from the battlefield and from politicians, that, you know, the initial intention was for this to be a three-day war and or a four-day, you know, a short operation. And obviously that hasn't happened. So there is clearly messaging to the domestic audience. The pressure on which is only going to increase as this continues. And the domestic audience is ultimately the one that matters most to the leadership and to the Kremlin.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 28th, 2022. Polina Ivanova is Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times. She has spent the better part of the last decade reporting from Russia for the Financial Times, for Reuters, and elsewhere. She joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk through the Russian military press conference that took place on Friday, in which the Ministry of Defense seemed to walk back Russia's war aims in the Ukraine conflict. We talked about what the Ministry of Defense said, how different or similar it is from previous Russian statements about what this war is about, whether it was intended for international or domestic consumption, or maybe both, and whether it provides a plausible basis for resolution of the conflict. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 28th, Polina Ivanova on Russia's New Line. So get us started with the Russian military press conference on Friday, about which you did a very interesting summary tweet thread. Give us a summary of what happened and what the Russian military is saying.
Sure. So on Friday, three top representatives of the defense ministry held a briefing in Moscow. They spoke to a room of journalists with an enormous screen behind them, just to set the scene for you, a sort of wall-sized screen with a slideshow going of images of the war and also of various maps representing what they were saying. And basically the press conference marked 1 month since the start of Russia's invasion on February 24th. And it was doing what Russians call podytozhe, so pulling together all the what they can summarize has happened so far, and also pitching a kind of new phase of the war as they see it. I mean, to describe what they were saying specifically, just, you know, from their, based on their words and how they were presenting the war and how they were presenting its outcomes so far and what they see as next steps for them. So that was how it was billed. And what they were effectively saying was, they started by kind of explaining more, you know, what Russia set out to do in Ukraine. So giving us a new narrative, I would say, about what the initial aims were of this invasion. So they presented documents, and they've talked about this before, but claiming that Ukraine was planning to attack Donbass in eastern Ukraine in March, and saying that this was a preemptive war by Russia. This is very much denied by Kyiv and its allies. And then they effectively stressed that the aim of the war had always been to liberate, as they would put it, the eastern Ukrainian region. we can argue and we can discuss whether or not that was what Russia actually set out to do initially and how it was presenting its aims and goals a month ago. But at this point in time, that's how they were showing it. So Russia's aim is now to focus on East Ukraine. Everything else, attacks across the country, the strikes that have been happening across the country, the blockades of lots of different cities, of regional capitals, you know, and Kyiv itself, they describe this as secondary, as a sort of almost a ploy to distract Ukrainian troops, to prevent them from resupplying the front in the east, and that the focus of this next phase of the war would be on securing control over the eastern region.
So there has been, I think, two big schools of thought about how to interpret this press conference. One of them, loosely speaking, is this is a bit of a climb down. You know, they've gone from wanting to denazify and demilitarize the entire Ukrainian state, which is both of which are understood to be code words for kind of regime change in Kyiv, and that this is a fallback to a kind of 2014 vision of what conflict with Ukraine looks like, wherein they don't aspire to topple the Zelensky government or install a Yanukovych-like figure. Rather, they merely want border adjustments in the Donbass and recognition of the independence of Luhansk and Donetsk. The other way to see it, which some commentators have been focused on, is that this is kind of a big distraction and that they're, you know, trying to appear to be doing that to buy themselves time to resupply and then actually stick with plan A. I'm curious how you read it as a, you know, as somebody who's sort of spent a lot of time talking to Russian Ministry of Defense people over the years.
I think the reason that there is a debate is, I mean, the debate is pretty justified. And the reason it exists is because different aims have been set out over the course of this war and before it. And the narrative has given us that we've been given by various Russian officials and Putin himself has been, of the casus belli, has been, you know, very mixed. So we've had, as you say, demilitarization of Ukraine, in neutral Ukraine, denazification of Ukraine, in very much in quote marks there. Denuclearization came up for a while as a point of discussion, you know, lots of sort of in Russian state media messaging appearing about, you know, a source in government saying that, you know, they were preparing a dirty bomb and this sort of thing. So there was denuclearization was discussed for a while. And then there was biological weapons and biolabs and, you know, needing to kind of get rid of that threat that Ukraine posed. And then there's, you know, this discussion of the liberation, so-called liberation of East Ukraine. So the fact that there has been debate isn't surprising because the aims have been, you know, we've been given lots of different aims. And I think it's likely that that is done in order to, you know, be able to pick one later. Potentially it makes it rather easier to then select which one you were initially targeting and say that actually all along, for example, we were going for the liberation of Donbass. So if you look back at what Putin was saying from the beginning, on the one hand, in speeches, he would say things like, you know, we do not plan to occupy Ukrainian territories at all. This is not Russia's aim. You know, this is the day that the war began. At the same time, he would talk about, you know, call on Ukrainians and on Ukrainian troops to overthrow the junta in power and, you know, call for a coup and overthrow the regime ruling on Ukrainian territory and this sort of thing, which would suggest, you know, totally different motives. So all of these contradictory things, you know, create this this lack of clarity, which means that we can then sit here and sort of listen to this speech by the generals on Friday and not be entirely sure which way to read it. I mean, I think the argument that Russia, you know, a lot of very good analysts have been talking for a while about how Russia needed to resupply, to pause, to slow down the process of its attack based on, you know, the needs of its military at this point and couldn't keep up at this point its attack and the same strength. So it's also very possible to read this as a attempt to stall or to to take time to pause, and it would fit into the timelines that analysts have been talking about for weeks, saying that at this point, around about now, Russia will need to put things on pause for a while in order to keep its invasion going. So it could be a ploy, it could be a genuine strategy, it could be a rollback, and it could be all of those things in one, in a continuation of this approach of giving lots of different messages and then, you know, picking which one fits later on.
So I'm interested, you refer to the war aims as stated a month ago. When you were talking to people a month ago, how consistent is the current line with what you were hearing then? Or is this really a change, either because this is a feint of some sort to buy time, or because that was, as they're now saying, a feint of some sort to distract Ukrainian military resources from the east?
Well, I think if you listen to what Putin was saying at the time and the justifications that he gave for war initially, I think they're really, they make it very clear and they fit into quite a specific worldview and plan. And ultimately, you know, leaving to one side what he said about NATO and what they had been, Russian officials have been saying about needing to kind of restore Russian power on the European continent and a balance that they believe was lost during the 1990s. Fitting into that narrative is this idea that Kiev was like under the thumb, as they would put it, of foreign leaders, and that it was a dangerous anti-Russia, and Putin called it a question of life or death for Russia as to whether, you know, Ukraine stays under its current leadership and with its current Western alliances. And he said that this was a red line that had already been crossed, and that's why Russia needs to take action, and that's why Russia needs to launch an attack. And this was the justification that he gave on February 24th. And I think, you know, if you measure him by that standard and measure the progress of this war against that aim, then what they were saying can be seen as a rollback. What the generals were saying can be seen as a rollback from what was the stated aim by the president on February 24th, which is, okay, not to occupy Ukrainian territories if you take him at his word, but if you also take him at his word, then it's a question of life or death for Russia if Kiev remains hostile to Russia and allied to the West and quote-unquote under the control of foreign leaders. So if you take them at their word, then it's a rollback from that position and from those aims.
I listened to that Friday press conference, and it did sound to me like it was an effort to, first of all, number one, deny the degree of failure, mm-hmm. but number two, to hint a little bit at what the likely preferred Russian basis for a ceasefire or a settlement would look like. Mm-hmm. That is, we seize a little bit more territory in the east, and we're prepared to withdraw from the rest, although there's sort of no reference to the Southern Corridor question, if Ukraine is willing to accept the territorial losses and we give up on the regime change element. On the other hand, I am sensitive to the sort of Ukrainian suspicion that this is a ploy. And by the way, you know, the irritation that the West sees, or analysts in the West see, a sort of moderation in the idea of, okay, we seize a lot of your territory instead of decapitating the regime entirely. Mm. To what extent do you think this is an intentional set of signals for international consumption rather than a domestic statement, hey, to whatever extent you're hearing about failures and casualty numbers, that's wrong. You know, this is all going according to plan.
Well, the phrase, this is all going according to plan, was, I think I counted it coming up three times in the briefing. So I think that is a message that they definitely want to convey to their audience. And I think they are very conscious of domestic pressures. I think those pressures are growing. As time goes on, people will feel, you know, ordinary Russians will feel the impact of sanctions more and more. I think it's relatively that impact is relatively limited so far, but what is set to grow, there's a sort of time lag on that. You know, we had images on television, on Russian state TV, I think yesterday on the weekend, of generals visiting injured Russian troops in hospital and, you know, awarding them medals. And I think all of those things together show that, you know, there is a buildup of domestic pressure. I mean, it gets harder, and the more casualties you have, the harder it is to say that everything is, you know, everything is fine and everything's going to plan. The longer this drags on, the harder it is to say that that's the case. And, you know, we've had so many signals, both from the battlefield and from politicians, that, you know, the initial intention was for this to be a 3-day war and or a 4-day, you know, a short operation. And obviously that hasn't happened. So there is clearly messaging to the domestic audience, the pressure on which is only going to increase as this continues. And the domestic audience is ultimately the one that matters most to the leadership and to the Kremlin.
So I guess my question then is, what are you looking for over, you know, you've answered a lot of my questions by framing the parameters of reasonable debate over them. What are you looking for over the next few days and weeks by way of the clarification of where reality is within that spectrum? What are the signs we should be expecting to see if, in fact, there has been a shift toward an Eastern Ukraine focus? What are the signs we should be looking for if, in fact, this is a, you know, negotiating position? On the other hand, what are the signs we should be looking for if this is actually a, you know, designed to create a strategic pause or principally meant for domestic consumption and it has no implications for de-escalation of the current conflict?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I hesitate, as many people do, to definitely interpret what is going to happen based on Russian statements. I think that's the easiest way to go wrong, because they often shift in time, and yeah, you don't know exactly what to expect. But I think,
wait, before you go on, I just want to pause you on that point. So you think it's really possible that this is an all of the above situation? It creates a strategic pause. It allows a focus on consolidating Eastern Ukraine. It communicates something for domestic consumption, and it communicates a potential international negotiating position.
Yes, absolutely. And cherry picking after the fact is quite useful. It's quite a useful tool to then leave options absolutely open. I mean, they did signal a specific change in direction, right? They did signal that we're going to focus on the East. And they also spoke about how they were going to do that, what this next stage of the war might look like. I mean, that is, we can probably assume that at least to some extent that will be then realized. They spoke about this refocus on the East, and then they talked about how the front in the East, because it's been a front line for so long, has been really heavily fortified. You know, they talked about cement structures in the ground and this sort of thing, and then said that in those circumstances, you know, heavy bombardment is used. So they didn't even, you know, if you listen to the Russian, they didn't even say that we're going to now heavily bombard East Ukraine, if you're talking about what signals we'll be looking for, right, in terms of how, whether it's refocusing on the Eastern Front or not. But they did so use a sort of passive voice to say that this is kind of the done thing. But you can read into it saying that, well, they're leaving themselves definitely a road, you know, they're signaling that that's the road that they could be going down, which is, you know, much more aerial bombardment in the East. So if we're talking about signals, that's one thing that we can look out for, is an intensification of the conflict in the East based on what they were saying specifically with airstrikes, with an intention to limit ground troop casualties based on what they were saying. But yeah, it could be all of the above, exactly.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20. So shifting gears a bit, you have been a correspondent in Russia, both for Reuters, as I recall, and then more recently for the Financial Times for quite a number of years, better part of a decade. I'm interested in just how your life has changed as this conflict has developed, and what it has been like being a, you know, Russo-British reporter for international news organizations in Moscow and in Russia more generally.
I mean, not straightforward. That's for sure. We've seen over the course of the past year and a half, I think, working out of Moscow, we've seen an intensification of this, of a crackdown on free speech, on, I think it all basically, often when we think about it, we think back to a timeline of Navalny's return to Russia, actually sort of flew with Navalny from Berlin to Russia. And from that moment of landing when he was detained, everything sort of snowballed really quickly. The process that we had seen happening in Russia for a while in terms of political freedoms and, you know, crackdowns on protesters and that kind of thing all just sped up hugely. And then in the past few weeks, in this kind of wartime era, it has skyrocketed. I mean, this has been the real shift. And seeing that sort of happen, it's sort of the trajectory that we'd been going down. Someone was saying that, you know, we'd put it sort of, you're kind of rolling and then suddenly you're speeding out of into outer space on this sort of thing. So that has been a big change. I think for me personally, one of the great difficulties of reporting all of this is your positioning with respect to it. So in Russia, you're a foreign reporter. In Ukraine, you're a reporter with Russian heritage. You have to navigate all of these things, which is also quite difficult. And how my life has changed is, yeah, watching this sort of rapid escalation in the crackdown that we'd sort of gradually been seeing build up and build up and build up over the past year and a half. It has meant that a lot of friends have left, a lot of media that I have relied on, colleagues, people that worked in independent media, have been forced to shut down operations, leave, or attempt to restart their work from abroad. There's also, of course, been the huge impact on colleagues and journalists who I've known for years from working in Ukraine. So who've also, you know, much more than anyone else, have had their lives upturned completely, or have continued, you know, have continued working very bravely in the circumstances. So a large community of people that I spoke with in Russia, or of friends and colleagues, have just sort of scattered around Tbilisi, Yerevan, Istanbul, the Baltics. Many are talking all the time about, you know, conversations have started focusing more on, you know, how do I use money because my cards have stopped working, my bank accounts have stopped working, you know, just logistical things, how trying to help people sort out travel arrangements, find visas, ways to stay in, because they feel at risk back in Russia. So it's been a sort of a huge shift in the past few weeks for Russians as well. But of course, nothing like in Ukraine.
And what about for your Twitter bio describes you as a Londoner and a post-Soviet baby. And these are things that used to be very natural to be, you know, when you and I met when you were a student at Oxford, and the idea of being a Russian-British student at Oxford was the most natural thing in the world. Now there's a lot of hostility directed to, you know, Russians with real estate in London. There's a kind of suspicion of that identity, and I'm wondering to what extent that's a factor in your life as well.
It is. It's always been something that Russians talk about in London for a long time, but I wouldn't want to emphasize it too much because I think it, you know, everything that I have experienced has been in recent weeks has been focused on understanding and seeing that there is a variety of opinions in Russia, and that the context there, it's a very, you know, there hasn't been this assumption that all Russians are supportive of, you know, all Russians support this war, and there's kind of a knee-jerk hostility immediately towards Russians abroad. I do think there is more to navigate. I think I also would not complain about that, because I think it is almost, you know, this has happened. I am a Russian passport holder. We're all, to some degree, if we have to carry the, you know, if we have to explain our positioning with respect to this war, I think fine, you know, that's not much to ask of people. And yes, it definitely has, you know, I'm talking to a hairdresser, for example. He asked me where I'm from the other day. I say Moscow. He says, oh, that's controversial. I'm like, yes, it very much is. But let's have this conversation. Let's talk about it. Absolutely. Because, you know, that's quite right that we should. Yeah, I think a lot of Russians are quite concerned about this. But what I try and do all the time is just to explain that there's been, you know, that I haven't had that experience, not in recent weeks. So instead, I've had good conversations about it.
So, you know, one possibility is that actually you end up with a sort of all of the above situation. That is, you create a strategic pause. Maybe there is more fighting, but it ends up stalemated in other parts of the country. And you end up with a East-only arguable win. And I guess that you then have to claim as victory to the Russian people. Is that plausible? I mean, if given the way the setup has gone, the magnitude of the losses, if Putin has to actually fall back for leave aside the international question, whether he could get a deal on that basis, something of which I'm rather skeptical. If he could he sell that as a win?
I think often we worry that, you know, we're not giving we're not giving Russia's leadership enough off ramp, you know, a way off so that they can sell it as a victory. And maybe, you know, that would actually, you know, precipitate a swifter ending to this conflict. I actually think that, you know, to its core base, the Kremlin is able to sell quite a lot. You know, it's able to sell almost anything if it has so far been able to some degree, at least, convince the population of the need for this war. So I think it is possible. On the other hand, you know, I think the support for the war so far has been, you know, polls are not very verifiable. Polls are not very trustworthy at this point in time for various reasons. They're a bit difficult to really trust in Russia at the moment, but there is a sense to which there is a majority still of support for the war. But that support is pretty shallow from everything that I get a sense of. You know, it's based in part of just sort of what is being said on television. When it's probed, when that support is probed, and there's a, you know, question of like, why, you know, but why is this war happening? Can we really get into some depth with it? It feels like there's a degree to which is quite shallow. So I think the ability to just present this as, you know, we stop here, we've prevented Ukraine from striking us first, which was the, you know, at the beginning of this press conference, I think it reads pretty thin, but it would allow us to stop at where we are now and not dig into a very, very long, drawn out war aiming to secure some other sort of much bigger victory, which would take, you know, months and cause much, much more destruction. So, I think it's sellable.
And what about sellable to the military elites who, and the security services, who have lost a lot of people and who have been humiliated? I mean, it's one thing to sell it to nationalistic people on the street in Novosibirsk. It's another thing to sell it to non-commissioned officers and flag officers. And there have been 5 or 6 or 7 flag officers killed who've lost people and who form an important part of your power base.
Yeah, it's a very good question and a difficult one to answer. Everything that we've seen, right, shows. I mean, this would be very much questioned on the Russian side, but from looking at videos from the front line or videos that are shared by the Ukrainian side, obviously, we see a lot of low morale, both in troops, and there have been some heavy losses, and as you say, losses on some very senior levels in the army. So whether or not that swings opinion towards continuing a war to secure a greater goal, or swinging it towards, you know, we should stop now before this gets worse, that's hard to say. If you, from their perspective, and from the perspective of everything that they were saying on Friday, one of these core aims of the military have been, in their view, achieved, in that they listed the destruction of targets, of Ukrainian targets around across the country. So 16 air bases knocked out, the strikes that have taken place on defense industry, you know, industrial plants that have that would be able to resupply or reconstruct Ukraine's army and its military infrastructure, this sort of thing. So I think for the army, potentially that, you know, that kind of list of targets that they have hit in order it to sort of destroy Ukraine's military potential and prevent it from restocking it easily or from rebuilding it easily. I mean, it's very difficult to verify how much of that is true, how much they actually have achieved that. But for them, that is, I think, a key goal that if they can, if they perceive it to have been achieved, then they see that they're kind of this enemy, this anti-Russia that's sitting on their doorstep has been sort of, you know, that its teeth have blunted in some way. So maybe that's the logic that they would go down.
I worry about the flip side of it, to be honest, that the Ukrainian military has revealed itself to be extremely able. The West has revealed itself to be more than capable of keeping the Ukrainians resupplied and resupplied with quite sophisticated weapons that are now battle-tested in significant confrontations with the Russian army and have done exceedingly well over a relatively protracted period of time. And I wonder if the message to the Russian army is that it has been, you know, there's a little bit of an emperor has no clothes quality, that this, you know, greatly, greatly feared military force that has the largest defense commitments of any domestic force in the world, just because of the size of Russia, has now been revealed to be dramatically less capable in ground combat than anybody imagined. And if I were senior Russian military, ending the conflict with that as the message would be pretty terrifying. Like, I would be worried that the Moldovans think this is a great time to take back Transnistria, that the Georgians are watching very carefully with respect to Abkhazia, you know, that like the degree to which the Russian military has been shown to be very defeatable by forces that we all assumed couldn't has got to be scary to senior Russian military contemplating a settlement on the basis of a fallback to Donbass.
Yes, if you mean from an international perspective, I mean, in terms of, as in, if you mean from a perspective how they're viewed internationally, and what message this sends on a global level, if we're talking about Georgia and Moldova and other countries, I think the ruthlessness that has been shown in Kharkiv and Mariupol and places like that, I think acts as a, you know, a potential messaging that is a deterrent, it acts as a deterrent. But and maybe that's part of the goal of it, with 80% of Mariupol's infrastructure destroyed and so many lives lost. But, you know, if this is presented domestically to the kind of domestic military as a project that has aimed to, as a mission to take Donetsk Oblast and Luhansk Oblast, the wider administrative borders of those regions, then for example, on Friday, one of the generals was saying that 93% of this Luhansk territory has now fallen under control of the Luhansk forces, who were sort of pushing the outer boundaries of their state, and 272 settlements have been passed under their control. Those are things that they can, you know, say that this was the most intense front, and, you know, this is what we're aiming for all along, and how, you know, this is our victory. You know, we wanted to secure this wider Donbass region. These are the elements that we have taken from it. So if it's a if it's a domestic message, that one, spinning it like that could you know, they have expanded that territory. They're on the ground. The facts on the ground do show that some of those areas have been taken. Internationally, there's, you know, the narrative war there appears firmly to have been lost. Yeah.
We're going to leave it there. Polina Ivanova, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was me, because we did it kind of on the spur of the moment. So I just recorded it myself. Hey, though, you need to do your part to support the Lawfare podcast. That means becoming a material supporter of Lawfare. You should also check out our many other podcast offerings, our increasingly diverse podcast offerings: Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, The Aftermath. Check them all out. They're there for you. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.